We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning, and welcome to Focus. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. In this hour of the show, we'll be talking about the politics of Northern Ireland, and our guest is Ed Maloney. He's a journalist and author who has many years' experience covering the conflict in Northern Ireland. And we'll be talking, in part, about his recent book that's titled Voices from the Grave, Two Men's War in Ireland. This book is based in large part on a series of interviews that were conducted at Boston College as part of the Oral History Archive on the Troubles. And they were interviews with two men, one from each side of this conflict, one who was in the Irish Republican Army, the other who was in the Protestant paramilitary, the Ulster Volunteer Force. The two men agreed to talk about their experiences with these researchers, with the provision that none of this would be made public until after their deaths. And this book has generated a lot of interest, particularly for what former IRA Commander Brendan Hughes has to say about his one-time associate Sinn Féin leader Gerry Adams. Ed Maloney served as Northern Ireland editor for the Irish Times and also for the Sunday Tribune. He now makes his home in New York. His first book, Paisley, was a biography of Unionist leader Ian Paisley. And then in 2002, he published a best-selling history of the Provisional IRA, A Secret History of the IRA. And the new book, out now, Voices from the Grave, is published by Public Affairs. As we talk, questions from listeners are welcome. We do hope that people will keep their questions brief and on the topic, and that will help us move along and accommodate as many people as possible. But certainly, people who are listening are welcome to call. 333-9455 is the number here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll-free, 800-222-9455 if it would be a long-distance call. And you may also send along your questions by email, will-talk@illinois.edu. Mr. Maloney, hello.
Hello, good morning.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
No problem.
I'd certainly want to talk about what's going on in Ireland today and also about some of the history that you explore in the book. And at some point, I definitely am interested in hearing some more about the Oral History Archive at Boston College and how that came about. Maybe the place to start would be just to have you talk just a little bit, and then I'm sure we can get into more details, about these two men that really are at the heart of the book, Voices from the Grave.
Yes, they're two of many people who were interviewed by researchers from Boston College, the archive was designed to reflect both hardline Republican, Irish Republican people, and loyalist paramilitaries, principally from the Ulster Volunteer Force. And Brendan, both of these men died within a year of each other. David Irvine, who was the UVF leader, died in 2007, and Brendan Hughes died about a year later. And extraordinary coincidence that the first two people whose recollections were then made available as a result of their deaths were these two characters who were really at the top and at the center of events for an awful lot of the troubles in Northern Ireland. Brendan Hughes was an IRA commander in Belfast. He served under Gerry Adams. He was imprisoned. He escaped from jail. He then headed the Belfast IRA until his recapture. He was on a hunger strike in 1980. When he left jail in 1986, when he was released from prison, he rejoined the IRA again at a very high level and was in charge of their the unit that hunts for informers and spies within the ranks of the IRA, and a lot of the stories are about that. David Irvine, a very different character from East Belfast, loyalist Protestant area. People who know Belfast will know the shipyard, the famous Harland Wolff shipyard, where David Irvine was born under the cranes, the shadow of the cranes of the shipyard. He graduated into the Ulster Volunteer Force in 1972, and the Ulster Volunteer Force, or UVF as we call them, was the most violent of all the loyalist paramilitary groups. It killed more people than any other group, and its speciality was no-warning bombs in bars, mostly Catholic bars, of course. And they also carried out some of the worst bombings of the Troubles, including the bombings in 1974 of Dublin and Monaghan, in which 33 people and many, many more were 33 people were killed and many, many more were injured. So he was with a very heavy bunch of people. He was eventually arrested, sent to jail, and underwent something of a political conversion in the sense that he moderated his views towards Catholics in Northern Ireland. And when he was released from jail, he became an important figure in the UVF's political front or political wing. And in that capacity, he steered the UVF towards accepting the peace process, which, you know, was an important thing to do, because if a group like the UVF had opposed it, then he would have had considerable problems. So his story is also interesting from that point of view, and I don't want to sort of simplify the story too much by saying that, you know, he suddenly became a good guy, because part of the strategy that he helped to develop involved accelerating and intensifying a killing campaign against Republicans. So he wasn't exactly an angel, but he ended up as a respected politician, someone who was a guest in the Oval Office and was recognized, I think, by and large, as a very articulate, probably the most articulate spokesperson that the Loyalist parliamentaries had ever produced. Brendan Hughes, on the other hand, died a disappointed and disillusioned man. He considered the peace process and the compromises which the Republican leadership, led by his former closest friend, Gerry Adams, to be basically to be a betrayal of all that he and others had fought for. And while he didn't advocate going back to war, and he didn't join or advocate anyone joining any of the dissident Republican groups, which we sometimes hear of these days, he nonetheless had broken with Gerry Adams and broken with the mainstream Republican movement by the time of his death, so much so that when it came to his funeral, he issued orders specifically that they should have nothing to do with his funeral. So he died in very different circumstances from David Irvine. David Irvine was successful. He reached a pinnacle of his political career. He saw the peace process, unlike Brendan Hughes, as very much a victory for Loyalists, because the Republicans had come to accept the existence of Northern Ireland and to take seats in the government of Northern Ireland, which was an extraordinary step as far as he was concerned. Brendan Hughes, on the other hand, died poverty-stricken in a small flat, a small apartment in West Belfast, disillusioned and I think somewhat bitter about his past life. Mm.
And does that generalize, do you think, to other people who are on both sides of this divide? That is, a loyalist would feel, as David Irvine did, that largely they accomplished what they were fighting for, but on the Republican side, that there would be a lot of people who would say that what they had done, what they had sacrificed, and I'm sure that they felt that they made sacrifices, really had been for nothing, and would be, like Brendan Hughes, angry at people like Gerry Adams, who they felt essentially had betrayed the cause.
No, you can't generalize like that, because mm-hmm. while there are, let's deal with the Protestant or Loyalist side first, mm-hmm. while there are lots of people like David Irvine who believe that the peace process has ended up with them, as it were, winning, if you like, for want of a better word, in the sense that Northern Ireland's position within the United Kingdom is now accepted by the leadership of the group which was at the forefront of trying violently to bring it down, you know. So for them, that's a huge victory. But not every unionist, not every person who believes in the union between Northern Ireland and Britain necessarily believes that. There's a very deep strain of insecurity that runs throughout Northern Ireland Protestant psyche, you know, very similar to the lack of security or insecurity that white people in South Africa would have had, or indeed whites in the Deep South in America would have had, and maybe some of them still do have, as we see in the Tea Party movement, and they're forever suspicious and always wary. and are on the lookout for trickery and so on and so forth. And a good number of them believe that the peace process is just a bunch of tricks to get them into a united Ireland. Equally, on the other side, well, there are those who share Brendan Hughes' view. The vast majority of Republicans seem to have gone along with the leadership, whether with any enthusiasm or not is a different question. But by and large, you would have to say that Brendan Hughes' view is a very strong view within what used to be the Provisional IRA, but it's not necessarily a strong view within the community from which it springs, or sprang, if that's the right word. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think so. Well, and maybe we also ought to make the point that here we're talking, when we talk about the Provisional IRA, this was an intensely militant splinter group off the IRA that was perhaps even more dedicated to the idea that armed struggle was going to be the thing to get them where they wanted to go.
Oh, yeah, this is the extraordinary thing about where they've ended up, because if you look at the origins of the Provisional IRA, there was a split in the Republican movement in 1969, brought about by the violence in the North, the sectarian violence in the North, and the absence of guns to protect Catholic areas from being attacked by Protestant mobs and by the police and so on and so forth. And it was a direct response and reaction to the inability of the old IRA to protect the Catholic areas that the Provisional IRA was formed, and also because the alternative strategy that the old IRA had been preaching, which was by and large one of politics, not the gun, you know, standing for Parliament and getting seats in government and so on and so forth, that became a big bone of contention at the time of that split. And the Provisional IRA were based on two principles: one, absolute, total, unquestionable faith in the power of the gun, and also complete rejection of politics. And here we are, what, 40 years later, and the same Provisional IRA has embraced politics and has decommissioned its gun. So that's a measure of how big the change has been.
Let me just very quickly introduce again the guest for this part of Focus 580. We're talking with Ed Maloney. He is a journalist and author who's written a great deal about the politics of Northern Ireland. He is author of several books, and his most recent, the one that's just come out, published by Public Affairs, is titled Voices from the Grave, Two Men's War in Ireland. It's about the Troubles and about two men in particular who were on opposite sides of this conflict. David Irvine, who was involved in the Protestant paramilitary in the Ulster Volunteer Force, and then the other individual was a man named Brendan Hughes, who was in the Provisional IRA. They both agreed to sit down and talk with people from Boston College as a part of this effort to collect oral history of the conflict. And then the agreement was that nothing would be published until after they had died. And in fact, David Irvine died in 2007. Brendan Hughes died in 2008. That's how it is that now this has become public, and our guest had the opportunity to draw on that material for the book that he has written. And it's out now if you want to read it. The 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. And you can also email us at well-talk@illinois.edu. Just for a second, I wonder if we might come back to the Oral History Archive. I'm just really fascinated by how it is that this came to be. Now there is that material that's collected there at Boston, that eventually, as it becomes public, that journalists and scholars and people will be able to take advantage of it. How did this actually come to exist?
Well, first of all, it's a tribute to Boston College that they had the foresight to realize just how valuable historically such an archive could be, and they backed the idea. But essentially, we go back to 2001. And it's clear by that stage that the Troubles are coming to an end. We've had the Good Friday Agreement, and even though there hasn't been yet a stable government, things are moving in that direction. It's clear everyone wants to go that way, and really what's in the way are just the details of the negotiations, which admittedly still took a few years to happen. But nonetheless, the thing is coming to an end. And I have long been an advocate of, collecting and archiving historical material. You know, there is a famous library in Belfast called the Lindenhall Library, which has become a repository for all the minutiae of the Troubles, and it's a fantastic collection. And I've always had a policy of passing on material that I have come across and giving it to the library so that it's there for posterity. And I've also believed that, you know, one of the huge gaps in our knowledge of the Troubles has been the story of those who actually did the fighting, who did the bombing and the shooting and the killing, you know. And this was an area which, for all sorts of reasons, but to really on the grounds that this was just not the sort of subject that many people wanted to go near, it hadn't been done. The other problem was that, you know, we were talking 2001, the Troubles had lasted 30 years, and already people who had been very prominent in the early stages of the Troubles were beginning to die off. Time was not on the side of waiting, sort of a decent period until the Troubles had finally ended or fully ended or ended to the satisfaction of everyone before you embarked on something like this. You had to do it more or less then and there. Otherwise, a lot of these people would die off, and their memories would fade and so on and so forth. So I had this idea of trying to interest people in collecting an oral history archive like this. The problems about doing it in Ireland, or indeed in Britain, there were two major reasons. First of all, you know, most institutions like universities were not at a stage where they felt comfortable about coming close to a subject like that. You know, these were still men of violence, and you know, there was a negative aura associated with doing a project like this, despite the fact that clearly there was historical value. So, you know, there weren't too many people terribly keen on doing something like this. Secondly, from the point of view of those who were going to contribute to the archive, there's a question of trust. Unfortunately, we've had a number of examples, not very many, but enough to foul the water, as it were, of paramilitary groups handing over papers to libraries and then the libraries making them available to the police, right? Mm. And, you know, there would be a great fear on the part of people that we were going to interview that if the library was, you know, in Belfast or in Dublin or in London, then one day the police would get hold of this material and use it against them. Whereas none of those problems existed in the United States, and particularly in Boston. Now, Boston College is blessed by the fact that it has two very far-sighted people, Tom Hatcher, who runs the Center for Irish Programs at Boston College, and Bob O'Neill, who runs the Burns Library there, and they both, first of all, recognize the historical value of such a project like this. And secondly, because the archive material, once it's collected here, or collected in Ireland, was dispatched to Boston, and it was put in a vault in the library, in the Burns Library, that our interviewees could be pretty confident, pretty sure that their material was safe and wouldn't see the light of day, and that only authorized people and a very small number of people at that would ever get to see them. Mm-hmm. So that was the origin of the thing. And you know, we had other problems to overcome as well, sort of related in a way to that question of trust. You know, normal oral history archive projects, there would be a fair sprinkling of academic researchers who were sort of trained in questioning and all that sort of stuff. The problem that we would face if using that type of personnel would be that the people that we were interviewing, IRA members, former IRA members, UVF men, former UVF men, all had their sort of code of omerta, if you like, you know, that it really wasn't, you know, they're not supposed to talk about this sort of stuff. And they were taking a huge risk in agreeing to give us interviews at all. And the fact that they would give them to total strangers who didn't know or trust would probably mean, A, that they wouldn't do it, and B, if they did, that the interviews would be very guarded. So we decided that, you know, one of the spin-offs of the Troubles has been a huge prison population of paramilitaries on the IRA side and on the Loyalist side. And an awful lot of these guys have gone on to become very academically qualified. They've sort of rediscovered themselves in jail, and when they've come out, they've sort of gone into normal life, and some of them have become academics. And we were able to trace two, one Anthony McIntyre, who'd served 17 years in Longkesh jail, who got himself a first-class honours degree in Longkesh, and then when he came out of jail, he got a PhD from Queen's University in Belfast. And the other was Wilson MacArthur, whose family were all UVF. He wasn't a member himself, but his family was. And he was an honours graduate in political science from Queen's University. So we had these two guys who were academically qualified, who were no longer active as members of these groups, who interviewees could be comfortable with, and who also were, and this was another point, is that your average, you know, academic researcher would not be familiar with the minutiae of parliamentary life in the way that these people would be, you know. Mm-hmm. And that's another advantage. And also that they would know when they were being spun a line, you know. You can spin a line to someone who doesn't know much about the subject, but it's much more difficult to do that to someone who's very familiar with the territory. So that was the basis. And then the second principle was that nothing would ever be released unless either you had the permission of the person to do so, which was extremely unlikely, or they died. And that was there to encourage candor on the part of the interviewees to make sure that they would know that there would be no comeback in their lifetime. They were therefore encouraged to talk as honestly and openly as possible.
We're just about at our midpoint here. I have a caller we'll get right to. And again, just I'll introduce the guest, Ed Maloney. He's a journalist and author. He's been writing for a long time about the politics of Northern Ireland. And his most recent book is Voices from the Grave, Two Men's War in Ireland. It's published by Public Affairs and does indeed draw on interviews that are part of this project that he was just talking about, interviews with two men who were on opposite sides of this conflict. Brendan Hughes, who was a commander in the Provisional IRA, and David Irvine, who was in the UVF. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and you can also email us at will-talk@illinois.edu. Caller here is in Champaign County. We'll talk with them, line one. Hello.
Hi. I wanted to talk more broadly about the troubles. I did one short fact-finding trip to Belfast, and I was fairly astonished by what I saw. But anyway, what I saw was I went to a community center on both the Catholic and Protestant side. The Catholic side was a very meager, very lively place, but surrounded by barbed wire and an observation, military observation tower was just down the block from it. Cameras around. The Protestant Center had, you know, just great facilities. They had a huge place with places for people to learn how to work on cars, and just not many people there when we went. But I mean, the class dimension of it is so much underreported, and it seems to me that this was around the time of the Anglo-Irish Accords being Belfast says no, and it was around the time of the poll tax. I was so misinformed. I thought they were opposing the poll tax as well, but they were actually, they had a big sign out over the castle saying Belfast says no. But so that just sort of sets the time frame and a little bit of the dimension of the place. But the class division was just so blatant, and this marching season has been more violent than in the past, and it seems to me that it's directly related to the collapse of the economy. There's no more of this harmonization money from the EU happening. Maybe it wasn't well spent on both sides of the Irish divide, but the economic distress seems to be exacerbating the marching season again, and so I think that it's very little visited. It seems it's mainly seen as sectarian, and they've always hated each other, and that sort of rap that's so common in a lot of places where there's a confusion between religiosity and maybe, you know. Well, anyway, would you address some of that?
Well, first of all, you know, you've got to bear in mind that when you were on that visit to Belfast, it was like nearly 25 years ago. It's a quarter of a century, and you know, things have improved for Catholics somewhat since then. But your general point is correct. And again, you know, while there's been violence at this year's Orange marching season, you know, compared to past years, it was like, you know, minor stuff, really. You know, there'd been much, much worse violence in previous years. I'm not trying to underestimate or understate what took place, but let's just get it into proportion a wee bit. But the general point is correct, is that the peace process, which is this huge compromise that everyone has signed up to. The IRA has agreed to end its war, to accept the right of people of Northern Ireland to stay British as long as they want to. The guns are decommissioned. The unionists have agreed to allow parties like Sinn Féin, the IRA's political wing, into government and share power with them and accord them more equality in a formal way than they've ever done before. So each side has sort of made a compromise. And the assumption was that in the wake of this this deal, this settlement, then, you know, there would be all sorts of economic and social improvements for the people in those areas where the trouble was at its worst. And what is happening, I think, with the Orange marching season and the response to it, the violent response to it, is an indication that the peace process has, to a large extent, left a lot of these people behind. All right? And they're still, they don't see any material or any actual change in their life as a result of the peace process. Why should, therefore, their politics change as well? You know? And I think that's what you're seeing. Hmm.
Well, this, I'm glad the caller raised that, because I certainly did want to, and I was also struck, as no doubt he was, about the coverage of this year's marching season. And again, this has been an opportunity at this particular point of year for a long time now for Protestants to march and for them to do this in a very confrontational way in Catholic neighborhoods. There have been violence surrounding these things. I guess I have the feeling that, reading some of this coverage, that somehow there was something qualitatively different about what had happened this year, particularly as it involved a lot of very young people, sometimes even children. At least that's what I've read in some of the coverage, and I wonder
I don't know where that came. You know, I'm very leery about these stories. Uh-huh. and when they're put out. You know, I can remember back in the 70s. You know, stories that were pumped out by the British Army Press Office about, you know, 8-year-olds touting machine guns and stuff like that. We never actually saw physical evidence that this was happening. You know. And I haven't seen any footage of, and I may have missed some of it, perhaps, you know, I stand ready to be corrected, but I haven't seen any footage of 8-year-olds out rioting during the Orange marching season. What I saw were large groups of mostly male youths of the age group, which in the past you would say, these are guys who are going to graduate into the Provisional IRA. These are guys who are like 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, that sort of age range, who were engaged in a fairly heavy confrontation with the police in the midst of one of these marches. Now, there wasn't a huge lot of them. I mean, there weren't thousands and thousands, but they were a considerable size nonetheless. But I didn't see any 8-year-old kids, you know. And that sort of smacks to me of, you know, the sort of the old bad propaganda days that we've had in Ireland, where the news gets skewed and distorted and what have you for political reasons to make a case, to make an argument. And essentially what this argument, you know, when you say 8-year-olds are involved in rioting, you say, first of all, there's no real basis for this. These are only kids doing it. And B, evil men are manipulating children. You know, that's the sort of storyline that follows as a result of that. Okay, mm-hmm. If it's there, let's see the evidence. You know, mm-hmm. I haven't seen any evidence at all of that. What I've seen is what I've seen in the past in Belfast, which is that age group, which is very worrying for the leadership of Sinn Féin, because this is one of their foundation areas, this area where this trouble was in North Belfast, an area called Ardoin. It was one of the very first areas to turn Provisional IRA back in 1969. If they've lost that area, then they're in trouble, because it's only a matter of time before they start losing other areas. So it's worrying from that point of view. Mm.
Our guest is Ed Maloney. He's a journalist who's done a lot of writing about the troubles in Northern Ireland. He worked for the Irish Times. He was the Northern Ireland editor of Irish Times, also for the Sunday Times. He now makes his home in New York, and he's the author of a recent book about Northern Ireland, Voices from the Grave, Two Men's War in Ireland. And as I explained, and he has explained, this was based in large part on the stories of two men, a Catholic and a Protestant, Brendan Hughes, who was in the Provisional IRA, David Irvine, who was in the Ulster Volunteer Force. Both of them cooperated in the Boston College Oral History Archive on the Troubles in Northern Ireland, where they had been collecting stories of people who were involved in this conflict and keeping them there so that some scholars and journalists can have access. But one of the things that they agreed is that unless those people gave permission or after they had passed, that material would be kept confidential. And indeed, the two men are gone now. One of them died in 2007, the other in 2008, and our guest, Ed Maloney, was able to draw on that material for this his most recent book. If you're interested, also, you might look at his other books, including Paisley, which is a biography of the Unionist leader Ian Paisley, and also his book, A Secret History of the IRA, which is a history of the Provisional IRA. Questions? Welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. It seemed to me that the part, particularly the parts of the book, Voices from the Grave, that really got the most attention, it was the section where Brendan Hughes was talking about his experiences. And one thing particularly that people, I think even before the book was published, people were talking about was what he might well have to say about Gerry Adams. He indeed did say that Adams, who has been a key figure in the peace effort, is now the president of Sinn Féin. What Hughes said was that Adams was a part of the leadership of the IRA, something that he, Gerry Adams, has steadfastly denied. Now, other people have said as much. I think you've said as much. How important was it, though, that now here is the voice of Brendan Hughes saying that?
Well, it's someone who was by his side. So, I mean, he was literally at Gerry Adams' elbow running the IRA's war in Belfast in the early 1970s. So, you know, when a guy like that says it's true, then you have to take that much more seriously, you know. And you're right. I mean, for reasons which I think a lot of people now in Ireland find very, very difficult to fathom, Gerry Adams has had this policy of denying membership of the IRA. Even though, you know, you go back and you look at the, the clippings from the early 1970s, and there you have him released from Lonkesh internment camp in June 1972, released by the British government as part of a deal with the IRA to call a ceasefire, and then he becomes a member of a delegation, an IRA delegation, which is composed of the entire leadership of the IRA, which is flown over to London for secret talks with the British government, and he's there as an IRA person. Everyone knows that. You look at newspaper clippings of his arrest in 1973, and you know the headlines are all, you know, top IRA man captured by army, you know, and it's about Gerry Adams. Everyone knows that. Yet he's had this policy since the early 1980s of denying any association of that sort with the IRA, and I have to say that for a lot of IRA people and of the sort of IRA vintage of Brendan Hughes, this was something that I think drove them to both anger and despair, because what it seemed to them to mean was that Adams, who issued a lot of the orders for a lot of the most controversial and bloody events in the early 1970s, in Belfast especially, was washing his hands of any responsibility. And basically saying, you know, these other guys did it, not me. And that is something, I think, which has, like, pushed a lot of people over the edge. And I've little doubt myself that it was one of the reasons why Brendan Hughes agreed to give this interview. I mean, it's unprecedented to get someone of that caliber, of that seniority in the IRA, to speak so freely about his experiences. And they've got to be pretty strongly motivated. And there's no doubt in my mind that that was the motivation, that he wanted to set the record straight, that he was angry at this, angry at Adams denying his own past, his own life, and therefore, you know, his relationship with Hughes. Now, he and Gerry Adams were like the closest of buddies during the early 1970s. You know, they Adams talent spotted Brendan Hughes as a very good organizer of operations and ambushes and bombings and stuff like that. And he pushed him further up the ranks of the IRA, and they ended up with, in 1972, Adams as brigade commander of the IRA in Belfast, running the show. The buck stopped on Adams' desk. And his operations officer, his number, I would say, probably effectively number two, legally number three, was Brendan Hughes. They were arrested together in 1973 in exactly the same spot, and they shared a cell in Lonkesh internment camp for a whole number of years. And together they devised a reorganization plan for the IRA in the mid-1970s, turn it into a cellular organization, boost the role of the political role of Sinn Féin, all sorts of other changes which they planned and plotted in Lonkesh, designed to revive the IRA, because by the mid-1970s, the IRA was facing defeat, basically. And as a result of their project, the IRA was able to stage a comeback in the late 1970s, and we saw that with the assassination of Lord Mountbatten and with the killing of paratroopers at Warren Point in 1979. These were all the fruits of the reorganization that these two men had plotted in jail together. And then when he got out of jail in 1986, he ran the vote-stealing campaign for Gerry Adams in West Belfast and helped him to get elected as MP. These two guys, that I interviewed said, were joined at the hip politically and militarily, personally, and what have you. They were very, very close. The peace process broke them apart. And the issue, I think, on which Brendan Hughes was most exercised was this denial of IRA membership. So not only did he, in his interviews, lay, as far as he was concerned, that question to rest, but he also went into considerable detail about the various operations that Gerry Adams had authorized as a senior figure in the IRA, both in Belfast and elsewhere, including the practice of disappearing people, which was something that started to happen in the 1970s. Individuals who had crossed the IRA either because they were informers or they had in some other way offended the organization would be sentenced to death, but the discovery of their bodies, the publicity associated with their deaths could be embarrassing, and so instead the policy was decided, the policy of burying these people, killing them and then burying them in secret graves was adopted, and Hughes is of no doubt, he says, this was a policy that was instituted by Gerry Adams. Mm. And that's extraordinarily controversial, particularly since the most notorious of the victims of the practice of disappearing people was this woman called Jean McConville, who was a widow, had 10 children, lived in a public housing project in West Belfast called the Divis Flats, which was full of IRA people, and was being used by the British Army as a spy. And the IRA discovered that she was a spy. She was initially given what we call a yellow card by Brendan Hughes, and that he gave her a warning and told her that if this ever happened again, you know, she would face death. Sure enough, she's back spying again a few weeks later, and the decision is taken to kill her. But you kill someone who's a woman, you kill someone who's a widow, and you kill someone who's got 10 kids, you've got a lot of explaining to do. You're going to get bad press. It could be a PR disaster. And so the decision was taken, Hughes says, by Adams, that McConville would be disappeared. And so she was taken across the border, shot in the head and put into a grave by a beach on Carlingford Lock, and where she stayed until I think it was 2003 when her body was rediscovered.
And that was this took place, these events, her murder, abduction and murder took place in 1972. Well, what was the reaction when this was published with Hughes saying, in fact, yes, Gerry Adams ordered this?
Well, you know, Gerry Adams has always denied any involvement in both in the McConville. Well, if you deny that you were in the IRA, then it follows, you know, that you're going to deny each and every allegation, every specific allegation about what activity you engaged in while in the IRA. And he's always denied He always denied any involvement in Jean McConville's disappearance. So the question, you know, to a large extent, the question is still out there unresolved, but the amount of evidence or the weight of assertions and allegations is tipping towards, you know, the conclusion that he did do what he did. Indeed do what Brendan Hughes said he did, which was to order the execution. And he backs it up with detail. He said the disappearance of people was undertaken by a special unit in the IRA called the Unknowns, which was modeled on a squad that Michael Collins had back in 1921. Mm. It was an elite group that did special operations for the Belfast Brigade. And it was under, according to Hughes, it was under the total control of Gerry Adams. It's Adams who gave the unit its orders, and it was to Gerry Adams that they reported back afterwards. So we're saying that, you know, the Unknowns were the unit, and the Unknowns were answerable to Adams. Adams was brigade commander. He was the top man in Belfast. Nothing took place in terms of IRA activity without his approval and foreknowledge, and so on and so forth. So his argument has sort of tilted the balance, I think, somewhat against Adams at the moment.
We have about 7-8 minutes left. Again, if you've just tuned in, our guest is Ed Maloney. He's a journalist who has reported a great deal, done a lot of writing on the conflict in Northern Ireland. He's now living in the United States, makes his home in New York. His most recent book is Voices from the Grave, Two Men's War in Ireland, and it is published by Public Affairs. We have another caller here to bring in to the conversation in Savoy, line one. Hello.
Hello. I have several questions, or two, anyway, if I'm allowed.
Sure.
And one is, I was wondering what the development of Joe Daugherty, who was imprisoned in the United States without charge and who had requested amnesty and during the Reagan administration was kept in solitary confinement for 8 years, the longest of any person who had never been charged. And then finally, in the late 80s, I can't remember exactly when, he was released and sent back to to Belfast and was to have been imprisoned there. And I understand that he was released after several years. But how does he play into the revelations? Or has he made an impact? And he eventually became, you know, at least in this country, subscribed to pacifism, or at least had withdrawn his support for the nationalist. I mean, the.
Mr. Maloney, are you familiar with the case?
Well, I know about the Joe Daugherty case. I mean, he's a sort of core celebrity in Irish America. Yeah. In Belfast, it's like Joe Who. No.
And so he led a quiet life after he was...
I guess so. I mean, you never hear of him. It's not really a story that...
hasn't been interviewed as to activity.
Well, you know, I can't tell you about who has or who has not been interviewed for this archive because we're only allowed
anonymous.
To disclose that sort of information when the person has died or if we have their permission. So I really can't go there, as they say here.
I see. The other question is, do you think the recent admission of the British government of their involvement in the Maguire Five, the people who...
Yeah, the Guildford Four, you're talking about Guildford Four and Burnham
Guildford,
Six. Uh-huh. Yeah. Mm. Well, that's not recent, that's like... That's
yeah, but I mean the recent admission of the Cameron government of the...
Oh, you're talking about...
You're talking about Bloody Sunday, I think.
Yeah.
Oh, okay.
Well, and let's talk about that, because I'm glad the caller raised it, because indeed I did want to have you talk a little bit about this and just how significant this this action of the British government was.
Well, it's significant in the sense that, you know, there you have it now in black and white, no conditions attached, no fine print, an admission by the British government that the people who were killed on Bloody Sunday by paratroopers were innocent people. And that's, I think, what a lot of the relatives wanted and hoped, and therefore are satisfied as a result of that. Having said that, of course, there are still a lot of, you know, areas where this Savile investigation, as they called it, you know, has proven to be unsatisfactory to some people. You know, if these people who died on Bloody Sunday were innocent people and were killed without reason, then does that not make it a, you know, a case of murder or manslaughter or something? And should there not be, you know, legal consequences as a result? That's the sort of question some people are asking. But I have to say that that's pretty much a minority view. Most people seem to be, certainly in the nationalist community and the Catholic community, seem to be satisfied with what Savile said, which was to exonerate and clear the names of those who had died.
Well, just coming down to the point, we have maybe about 4 or 5 minutes. It seems that, you know, reading the stories of these two men, particularly reading the story of Brendan Hughes, you wonder, and you think about conflicts like this, where you have two sides that are very unequal. And here, again, what I'm thinking of, I guess, are the IRA on one side and the British government on the other. Particularly when you think about the armed struggle, what did the people in the IRA who were involved in the armed struggle think that they would be able to accomplish?
Well, you know, that's the big question. You know, I don't think it's possible to avoid the conclusion that really, after about 1972 or 1973, the IRA had lost whatever chances it had to achieve the end result that they were looking for, which was to get the British out of Ireland altogether. 1972 is the peak year of the Troubles. You know, there were so much violence going on, so many people involved, that you know, at that time it did seem possible that the British would seek a way out. That it was such an awful bloody mess that they would do almost anything to get out of it. That's the year that we had the IRA ceasefire, and that's the year the contacts with the IRA started. But, you know, they led to nothing, basically. That broke down. And then gradually, slowly, and this is, you know, a story that, you know, Americans should be watching in terms of Afghanistan and Iraq, because the parallels are very, are uncanny. You know, one of the reasons why I always thought the Americans were crazy going into places like Iraq is that you were stirring up a hornet's nest that you couldn't control. And you contrast that with Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland has 1.5 million people. It's tiny. You know, Bronx, where I live, has more people than that. Of that 1.5 million people, how many people are you talking about getting involved in terrorism stroke paramilitary activity? 20,000-30,000. So you've got a very, very small terrorist population to monitor and to keep under surveillance. It's an island. Therefore, it's very difficult to get arms shipments in. Right? The IRA, therefore, spent a lot of its time and energy making its own weaponry, right? Because they couldn't sometimes bring the weapons or buy the weapons that they wanted. That was not a problem in Iraq. It's not a problem in Afghanistan. And the British soldiers who came in spoke the same language as the people they were fighting. They watched the same TV stations, and they probably supported the same football clubs. They had a lot of things in common. They may not have understood or may have misunderstood each other's history, but at least they could understand, have a conversation about it. None of this applied in Iraq or indeed Afghanistan. And yet, in Northern Ireland, with all these things going for them, it took the British 30 years to get out.
We just have about 2 minutes, but in looking at these men's stories and reading about them and learning more about them and their lives, do you come away with a better understanding of what it is that draws people in to violence like this?
Yes, I think it is. I mean, if you look at the common factor which drove both men into doing something which normal human beings would be very loath to do, which is to join a secret organization which is pledged to kill other people, right? Mm. That's a big, big jump in life, right? And to do that, you need to be very, very strongly motivated. And I think in both cases, David Irvine joined the UVF after this horrible day of bombing, IRA bombing in Belfast called Bloody Friday, in which nine people were killed and hundreds of people wounded. Terror on the streets of Belfast. That's the thing that pushes him over the edge. He wants to strike back at people who he believes are attacking him. Brendan Hughes joined the IRA in the wake of the sectarian violence of August 1969, when loyalist mobs, aided and abetted by the police in many cases, tore through Catholic areas, burning entire streets down. It was the desire, the need to protect, to hit back at those who were attacking that led Brendan Hughes into joining the IRA. And that's been, I have to say, my experience of virtually, I mean, I cannot really think of one person that I ever met who was in the IRA or the UVF who joined these organizations after reading a book or watching a film or reading a newspaper article. Virtually all of them joined after they had a personal experience which pushed them over the edge, whether it be, let's say, in the Republican sense, getting beaten up by a soldier or abused by the police or family members abused. On loyalist side, seeing members of their family killed or friends killed. It's motives like that that cause people to join these organizations, and that applies whether it's in Ireland or Afghanistan or in Iraq or wherever. I think that's a common human story.
Well, there, we'll have to leave it. If you want to read more on Northern Ireland, this is one place you can go. The book is Voices from the Grave, Two Men's War in Ireland. It's published by Public Affairs Books by our guest, Ed Maloney. He's been writing about Ireland for a long time, served as Northern Ireland editor for the Irish Times and also for the Sunday Tribune. Mr. Maloney, thank you very much for talking with us today.
No problem. Bye-bye.